You're listening to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, your escape to reality.
Hello and welcome to The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Today is Wednesday, August 12th, 2020, and this is your host, Stephen Novella. Joining me this week are Bob Novella.
Hey, everybody.
Kara Santa Maria.
Howdy.
And Evan Bernstein.
Good evening, folks. Wait, where's Jay?
Jay is off this week. He actually, I decided to give him a vacation, which
you unchained him.
He's on a family vacation this week. Yesterday was his birthday, so this is like his birthday week, summer.
Right.
Oh, fun.
Happy birthday, yeah. Jay.
Happy birthday, Jay.
Yeah. It's like also like we haven't taken a vacation all year. None of us.
No.
You know?
I haven't really gone
anywhere. Where did he, what are they doing for vacation?
I mean, they're just doing a staycation kind of thing where they're going to be local, but they're just doing all family time stuff.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yeah. We've done weekend things, you know, but like, so this past weekend, I think we said that we were going to go camping, but there was a tropical storm came through.
Sure did.
Yeah, that. And then what happens is, you know, it blows down all the trees. You know, it also blows down a lot of branches. And so every state park in Connecticut closed because broken branches are a huge death risk. You know, they fall down on anybody. People walking through the woods, you know, after a storm, it's really risky. Mm. And then they started to open up slowly, but the one that we had booked was still closed on that weekend.
Mm-hmm.
So we basically just did backyard camping. It was still a lot of fun.
That's cute.
Yeah, it was good.
It was.
How are school things now? I don't know if it's like around the time in the U.S. where kids usually start school, but for those of you who have kids, I guess all your kids are older, and Rachel's already homeschooled, isn't she, Evan?
Yeah, Rachel's been going to an online academy since sixth grade, and she's going to be a senior this year. Which starts September 14th. Yeah, but there's...
Everything's delayed. Usually it's the end of August, like last 2 weeks of August is when school starts again. Right before Labor Day, you know.
The week before, usually.
Yeah. And then, but it might be a little bit delayed. And for my daughter's high school, she's going to be a senior in high school as well. They're doing 2 days, only 2 days in the classroom. Or two and a half, like two and then every other third day, and then so half time basically.
Well, that's kind of cool. And then the rest of the time is online.
Rest of the time is online. Yeah. So just like half as many kids in the school at any one time, so they get social distance. Yeah.
That's such a smart way to do it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we'll see how that goes.
I've been seeing so many like social media posts from teachers that are like, I was told to social distance my classroom, but I still have to fit 30 people in. So this is the best I got. They're a foot apart.
That's not social distancing.
That doesn't count.
Exactly. Yeah. And I saw one post from a teacher. It was so sad. She was like, this is what my school gave me for PPE for the year. A homemade face shield, a leaking bottle of hand sanitizer that saturated the mask, and one pair of gloves.
That's
it was like, cool. Life. Yeah.
That's the issue.
Like, that's the problem. Like in a lot of like poor school districts, like I just don't know how they're going to handle this.
It's terrible.
Well, before we fully move on to the COVID update, follow up on the camping, I wanted to just say also that yesterday, as we're recording this, August 11th was the peak of the Perseid meteor shower. So we had a clear night when we were camping.
I
brought my telescope, so we got a really good view of Saturn and Jupiter. Everyone was
those are great.
That
right now
was amazing,
and we all got a good view of the Perseid meteor shower.
Most of us did.
Awesome.
We didn't all see everything, but everyone got to see one really good meteor at least.
Except Jay.
I love that.
Except Jay.
I saw one
that may be the best I've ever seen. This thing like tore through like the entire sky and left like this like smoky trail behind it.
I love
that very briefly, like very briefly covered most of the sky. I have never seen anything like it. We all lost our shit when we saw that because it was so intense. I've never seen anything quite like that. The only thing that could rival that was when I saw a meteor split in two. That was intense.
Ooh,
it was definitely a top two event. And
so I saw also one of the best meteors of my life. I think it was the second most dramatic that I've seen. But this one, I've never seen this before. As it was streaking across the sky again, it was a huge one. It clearly wasn't a grain of sand. It was a big meteor. It was wobbling. Like the path was wobbling. So it must have been like an elongated rock that was tumbling.
And
the aerodynamics was just making it.
Oh, my God.
It was amazing. I'm like, what the hell? I never saw that before.
That's awesome.
Very cool. Very cool.
And it all happens within a second, and then it's over.
And then it's gone. And I know, and I'm like, ooh, 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 like pointing at it. And but by the time everyone looked, it was gone.
Yeah, that's the tough part about meteor viewing. I know you see things and other people can't because they were looking
in
the other direction.
Jay's two young kids are there, and they're like, I want to see one. Like, you got to keep looking. You know,
you have to look up the whole time.
Yeah, you got to keep looking. Can't be distracted. Up, they don't have the patience to do that. You know, it's funny.
That's we bought funny. These recliner chairs for outdoor nighttime sky viewing that lean like all the way back. You can basically look, you know, adjust it so you can look straight up, 90 degrees straight up from any angle you want. So it's specifically designed for that. And we've had good success with those. You know, keeps your head.
It's really only way to do
rested.
It.
When
I go out stargazing with people and they just have chairs, I'm like, you're going to get so sore.
You might as well lay on the ground.
I always bring a camping pad and I lay on the ground with a pillow. That's the best way to stargaze.
Absolutely.
But a lot of people don't. They just want to sit there and crane their neck. And I'm like, you're not going to see anything. Yeah, you can't crane. Doesn't work.
And the path of these meteors was directly overhead. So if you weren't looking straight up, you were not going to see them.
I love that. I'm jealous. Yeah. It's been a bit cloudy here in the bonnie Scotland, but I was up in the Isle of Skye last week, which was amazing. So it's been really beautiful. And I got like 3-4 straight days with no rain. So I saw...
Oh, that's great.
I know, it's amazing. So I saw Highland cows and lots of sheep and lots of really cool like Iron Age ruins and old castles. Ooh. And just a lot of neat stuff. So that was a lot of fun.
Is that the most northern latitude you've ever been, Kara?
Huh. I don't know. It might be, actually, now that you mention it. Because I've never done, like, Iceland or Greenland. And the times I've been to Canada,
Alaska?
I haven't been that far north. I have been to Alaska, but only to Ketchikan. So I should actually compare those latitudes. I'm going to look it up. And I'll get back to you.
Please. Please.
So we could shift really quickly to a COVID update. We're going to be talking about a couple of COVID-related news items, so we won't get into those until we get to that segment. But quickly, the numbers, the worldwide cases, over 20 million now. Worldwide deaths, over 750,000. For the U.S., deaths are over 165,000. And total cases are over 5 million in the U.S., so yeah, the pandemic is raging on. The daily new cases is still plateauing, but at a very high level. It's not really coming down. Daily deaths are, you know, it's hard to tell. They're basically still going up, maybe plateauing, but again at a very high level in terms of the whole pandemic. So it very, like, if you're looking at the data, it looks very much like we're still in the middle of this thing. You know, we may be, you know, we only in retrospect we'll be able to tell if we're getting past the peak. Again, like in June, you might have thought we were getting past the peak, but we really were at the beginning of a second wave or a second peak of the first wave, depending on how you want to look at it. So, yeah, it's still going on. Still going on.
It's spreading pretty quickly in Hawaii from what I've read recently.
Yeah. Yep. You know, a lot of people are talking about pandemic fatigue. It's like, yeah, we've been there for a while, actually. So I think everyone's got to take a deep breath. I mean, if you're in a country that's doing great, good. You know, if you knocked it out the first time around and you're lucky, good for you. In those countries like the U.S., you know, that did not do that, we basically wasted our shutdown. You know, we didn't do it enough and we opened up too quickly. And so it's actually come back with a vengeance, even worse, you know, than what it was when we were shut down the first time. And I think, I don't know, it's hard to imagine we're going to get this under control without another shutdown, you know?
And if you're in a country where you were just lucky, I mean, don't expect that to be the end of it either. That's the important thing. Like, there are places where it was handled well, and as cases crop up, they're handled well and it's contained. And then there are places where it just, you didn't get hit hard yet, but it could happen, you know?
That's right. No
one's
immune.
We're seeing that all over the U.S. We're seeing that the rural areas are starting to get hit really hard now.
They thought they were going to skate by, but they just hadn't been hit yet.
Yeah, up in the Isle of Skye, I noticed that people were handling it really well. I think here in Scotland, kids are going back to school. So their region, Scotland, fared a lot better than England, which is actually not doing well at all right now. But I noticed that when we would go into shops, because shops are open, and some restaurants were even open, which still freaks me out. So I've been like very, I only want to do that if we're sitting outside and it's really distanced. But in the shops, they're just very good about every single shop has a bottle of hand sanitizer at the front and you can't come in without a mask. You have to sanitize on your way in and on your way out. And they like watch you. If they're not being distanced, people will tell them you need to wait in the stairwell while this family moves through. A lot of them had like only two people in the store at a time or four people in the store at a time. And they were actually really enforcing it, which was nice to see. And that's really how you do it. Like there are places where they have an economy. It's not booming, but at least it's getting back, and they're just doing it the right way to prevent spread, which I think is good.
Yeah. So if you look at worldwide, you know, the death rate, you know, of it's, if you look at the people who have died versus the people who have recovered, it's really settled in at around 5%. You know, obviously the longer this goes on, the more data we have. Yeah. 5%.
That's rough.
That's high. So again, it depends on how you count, like what is the quote unquote death rate. But if you follow just, you know, deaths versus recovered, that's the number. It's high. It's pretty high. You know, and a lot of people, a lot of the experts are saying, and I think this is, you know, the data supports this, the data that I've seen, that this is, you know, we're not going to get this under control pre-vaccine, you know. We're probably not going to just develop natural herd immunity.
No, and there's these mini experiments that are happening, like in prisons where the virus has run rampant and herd immunity, even in these small closed places, it's not working.
Yeah.
Right. It's not working. For herd immunity, I mean, what would you need to get for herd immunity to kick in? Like 70 to 80% or more,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, but there are places
that are
where
near that?
I think there's one article that's been written about a lot lately, a prison that's not done well.
So in terms of like how many people do you need to be immune in order to have herd immunity, even at 40%, it really starts to shut down spread of the virus.
40%?
Of course, the higher a percentage you have, the less able the virus is to spread. But if you combine even a 40 or 50% you know, herd immunity with social distancing and mask wearing, et cetera, then you could, it makes it a lot easier to shut down the spread, especially again, if the people that are at highest risk, you know, frontline workers, et cetera, are the ones who are immune for whatever reason. I mean, that's why, of course, like vaccine efforts would focus on the highest risk people first.
Yeah.
But we'll talk about more about the vaccine on my news item. But.
Oh, yeah.
Sure. So there's San Quentin here in California, has a population of 3,260 people, and they've already had 2,200 cases. And so they're looking at 2/3 of the population, which has been infected, and they're still getting new cases, like 60, like about 30 a week. So they still haven't achieved herd immunity, or at least that's one way to look at it, in a closed population. So that does not fare well for, you know, the early nations that thought, okay, we'll just try and go for herd immunity.
Right.
Yeah, which is a ridiculous idea anyway.
Yeah, exactly.
Not with a virus this deadly.
Yeah, not for a deadly virus. You can't. Yeah.
Not worth it. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's move on to the news items. Kara, actually, you're going to begin. You and I are going to do COVID-19 related news items. You're going to tell us about COVID-19 quackery in Afghanistan.
Yeah. So there's a really good kind of deep dive investigative piece in Undark that was written by Rushi Kumar, an Indian journalist who's actually working in Kabul. So this is a really... She did a nice deep dive of what's been going on kind of under the radar, in many cases across Afghanistan. And I think it does a good job to touch on the things that we often talk about here on the show, which are how does pseudoscience run rampant, especially when there's, I think, cultural phenomena that help to promulgate it. And in Afghanistan, what we're seeing is that these kind of herbalists, these traditional healers, are often offering quote unquote cures. So there are obviously a lot of very successful and very science informed physicians, but in very, very poor places. Sometimes there is not a local doctor that's easy to get to. This journalist covers the story of a man named, Alam Gulal. Gul Alam. So Alam Gul Alam was very sick, and Alam Gul Alam decided that he needed something more than what the doctors were giving him because he had been sick for a couple of months. So kind of classic COVID symptoms, sore throat, really bad chest pain, shortness of breath. So he'd gone to the doctors, gotten medications, and just had this kind of chronic case that you're seeing happening in a lot of people. He'd been dealing with this chronic pain for some time, and he, like many people in the region, heard of an herbalist who is actually trending on YouTube. He has a lot of videos. He has like a website. I think people were, or maybe he's got social media. I don't know if he has a website, but a lot of social media. And his name is Haji Muhammad Al-Khazai. Al-Khazai was offering what he was calling a legit cure for COVID. And I shouldn't say was, because he's actually still offering it, even though he was shut down. So that's another
calling it a cure
other problem that
okay.
we'll get to. Calling it a legit cure, and not just a cure, a prevention. Like, he has an assistant who works with him at this clinic in Kabul who was willing to sit for an interview for this journalist. The herbalist didn't, but the assistant said, you know, he's been doing this for decades. He's well respected. He gave it all to his family. We take it preventatively. And the assistant said, I've seen thousands of people and I don't wear a mask and I've not gotten sick yet.
This sounds like hydroxychloroquine.
Right?
That's what it sounds like, the stories behind it.
It's like, of course, one of these, you know, anecdotal stories that, A, can neither be confirmed nor denied, but even if it were confirmed that his assistant hadn't gotten sick amongst a lot of exposure, that doesn't mean that this treatment worked. It could mean that he's asymptomatic. It could mean that he has, an immune response that ever prevented him. Not everybody who, you know, gets exposed gets sick. So that's one of these really frustrating things about anecdotes, and especially about propagandized anecdotes. So the idea here is that people would come and they would take this treatment, and the treatment was drops. So there were individual drops that were given, I think a series of two or three drops that were given. And so people would show up to the clinic, they would wait in a really long line, and then they were in a cramped basement for hours, and then finally they were able to get this herbal medicine. So right there, there's a big problem. A lot of sick people going to one site, you know, traveling from very far away to go to one site and probably not using any appropriate PPE because this isn't a clinic where there are any sort of regulations or where there are any trained physicians who are working to prevent the spread of infection. So you've got sick people in close quarters. The ones who already aren't sick might be getting more sick. They might be bringing family members. Some of them are taking it preventively. So of course there they could be getting exposed. And then they're taking these medicines. Now the individual that was interviewed for the story, Alam Gul Alam, he said, I felt better immediately. I was cured. And now I want to I've had a real spiritual awakening because of course there's a real religiosity that's kind of interwoven into these kinds of treatments, right? Because these herbalists are deeply religious herbalists. And so a lot of the rhetoric that you hear in the YouTube videos or in the testimonials of people that have been treated, especially by somebody like Haji Muhammad Al-Khazai, is that, you know, Allah chose this for me. Allah, you know, gave me the recipe for the treatment. And this is why I've been able to bring it to all of these poor people. And so he said he felt better immediately. And it's like, okay, so what's happening here? Is this placebo? Is this whatever? Well, the government actually went in to investigate because they were concerned. You know, they've been sending out really strict messaging about seeing a physician, getting tested, getting the appropriate treatment. And yet they feel like a lot of this work has been undermined by these traditional herbalists. So this herbalist who kind of had like a massive following, they said, we're going to go and see what he's actually administering, because if this is a drug and it's not regulated, that's not legal. And they tested it. And it turns out that it was because he said this whole time, by the way, I can't tell you what's in it. Of course, it's proprietary and it's guarded. But it turns out that it contained very high doses of opiate medicines.
Mm.
So I think it was straight opium.
Well, Afghanistan, I mean, that's a fair assumption.
Absolutely. It's the world's leading grower of opium.
Yep.
Yeah, they tested it and found opioids like morphine and codeine within these drops. And, you know, he's been saying all along, no, this is a mixture of 11 herbs. Some boost your immune system, some prevent the disease, blah, blah, blah. Turns out he's giving people opiates. So, of course, they're feeling better right away because they're getting a pretty heavy dose of pain medication. The real concern, though, is that they're going to only feel better for like a day, right? And then they might want to come back for more. And then they might start to need higher doses, because when you're administering unregulated pain medicine on without a regimen, like without a schedule, then all of a sudden you're not actually working towards treating the disease. You're working towards mitigating symptoms only, and not even mitigating symptoms, mitigating the pain associated with the symptoms. And so this is a big problem that the government feels is really undermining their public health initiatives. But there's another interview in the article, which I think is really, really smart. There's an interview with a physician and public health official who says they don't think the government handled this well, because what they did is they went on public television and said, we tested this herbal treatment. It's just opiates. You guys are being scammed.
Mm-hmm.
And whereas we here on SGU and maybe in the West and maybe those of us who, you know, are all about promoting science-based medicine say, okay, that's exactly what they should do. Apparently, it is not always the most appropriate thing to do in a deeply religious country where in some ways the reaction, it's kind of like that double down reaction that mm-hmm. we talk about where the reaction is, oh, you're insulting the religion. You're insulting our faith. And because you're now insulting our faith, I'm going to stop trusting you as an institution.
Mm-hmm.
So what they've done is they've sort of changed their tone now. And now they're really working towards targeting misinformation. They're working towards promoting good hygiene education and promoting good education around when you should see a doctor instead of working to denigrate, or maybe that's not even the right word, but to sow fear and distrust, because apparently there is a backfire effect that's happening in some of these places where people might trust a traditional healer maybe a little bit more than a physician. And so when the government, which is already seen as an institution of oppression, is speaking in a certain tone about these religious institutions or these sort of relationships with religious officials, it actually is going to sometimes hurt their cause a little bit more than help. So it's really about speaking the language of the people. You know, we say this a lot in science communication. Number one, know mm-hmm. your audience. You have to know your audience if you're going to work on how to reach your audience. Mm-hmm. And you have to know what their sensitivities are and what's going to cause them to shut down. So it's about that finding common ground so that the message can be spread in a way that feels appropriate and is actually heard. Because what's the point of having good public health information available
right.
if no one's going to listen to it? And it's a makes tough sense. Balance. Yep. And this is a great example of it, that's what's happening in Afghanistan right now. So hopefully we see improvements. And it seems like, luckily, the people, the public health officials who are working on these campaigns are listening and they're doing good science and saying, oh, crap, you know, our first attempts weren't working and we're getting a lot of backlash. We need to change our approach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a tough situation. I mean, it highlights a couple of things, you know, that we like to talk about at science-based medicine. You know, so one is that's really interesting is that putting like opiates are essentially what we would now, you know, consider to be drugs of abuse or recreational drugs or mind-altering drugs, addictive mm-hmm. drugs, cutting that into your herbal remedy is a scam that's literally hundreds of years old, right? That's the patent medicines that predated the FDA in the U.S., for example, all had in them either cocaine was, I think, the most common thing, probably, or opiates.
Or but some heroin. Know, yeah, opiates. And also just alcohol. Just pure alcohol was pretty common too.
You know, it's almost like a joke. Like, I'm taking it for medicinal purposes, you know. But that's what it was. It's like, and that was, you know.
But that's because it makes you feel better.
You make what it, but it's all, you put a bunch of snake oil with all kinds of crazy claims in there and just put little opiates in there or cocaine or whatever and people feel great.
Magical.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. For a time, yeah, it's nothing to hurt.
Yeah.
So that's, you know, that's interesting. The other thing is that when you mix your medicine with religion, it's really, really hard. Because then how do you regulate medicine if people are if people are just going to defend it by saying, well, this is our faith.
You can't extricate.
It makes it impossible. It makes it impossible.
It's something
and that's
other.
Why, that's why alternative medicine, the whole alternative medicine movement is trying to deliberately blur the lines and exist in this gray area of religion. A lot of alternative modalities,
especially
are
in the
religion.
West.
You know, they are religious belief systems.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But it's like all the crap we've adopted in, like, you know, in parts of Europe and in the US where it's like, oh, you know, all of the alternative medicines and the Ayurveda and like the things that actually, or like we talk about a lot, right? Traditional Chinese medicine, like adapting these things that we love to think of as being really ancient. But it's like this, sometimes it's not ancient at all. And other times it's like repackaged for Western consumption. And all the religious spiritual shit has been completely stripped out. And it's just packaging.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's been stripped out or modernized, like given a more benign, like new agey kind of touchy feely angle to it, and some things that would sound less palatable to another culture are softened or stripped out. But I also think that the superstition of another culture also can sound exotic, right? You could make it sound like if you talk about bloodletting. No, you know, to a Westerner, that just sounds like snake oil. That's just ancient medieval medicine. But you talk about qi or acupuncture, it's the same exact thing, mm-hmm. but it sounds more exotic, you know, and then you could wrap it up in some kind of new agey
mysticism.
And then you claim traditional status, right? It's all a way of shielding it from quality control, from science. From investigation, you claim religion, you claim it's traditional, it's cultural, whatever. It's all part of the scam.
It's a cloak.
Yeah, it's a huge scam. And actually, it ends up hurting indigenous people or local people in the end, because what ends up happening is that people like us, skeptics, can see right through it in the West. And so we talk about dismantling it, but it might make it so that it's harder for us to understand why somebody who grew up with a religious practice that was inextricably linked to medicine can't find modern kind of Western medicine palatable or can't integrate those things, because we think of traditional medicine as this bullshit Westernized repackaged version, when in lots of cultures, that's not what they're doing. They're doing something that's far more deeply in the cultural practices. And that's where it gets really complicated.
Yeah. Although mixed with snake oil, you know, because they don't.
For sure. That doesn't mean it's not snake oil. Sometimes it's pure snake oil. Sometimes it's not.
Sometimes it's dangerous, you know.
The fact that it actually is cultural and not just trendy.
Yeah.
You know, I think it's easy for us to discount it and go, oh, because we're thinking of people in Santa Monica.
You have to approach it differently. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay, let's move on. So I'm sure all of you heard that Russia has a vaccine for COVID-19.
Oh, I did hear about that. Did they really call
I'm
it
scared.
Sputnik?
They called it Sputnik 5.
That's ridiculous, first of all.
That's so on the
I almost laughed out loud when I heard that.
Yeah.
Almost.
So, you know, unfortunately, this is pure propaganda. So what they did was they took a vaccine that's in development with a Russian pharmaceutical company, and they just gave it approval, even though it hasn't been tested yet. It's basically at the same stage as a lot of other vaccines are. It's not even the furthest along, but they just declared victory early and said, oh, we're the first ones with the vaccine. No, you're not. Nope. You just decided to approve the vaccine before it's even tested in phase 3 clinical trials.
There are vaccines that are further along than theirs.
Yeah, they're further along. Exactly. Wow. So the vaccine that they're developing is an adenovirus vaccine. So you take an adenovirus, which is a common cold virus, and you weaken it so it doesn't cause much of an infection. And then they genetically altered it so that it produces the spike proteins of the SARS-CoV-2. And so then if you infect somebody with it, that's the vaccine. They will develop antibodies to the spike proteins, and then that would give immunity to SARS-CoV-2, to COVID-19. So it's fine. It's a reasonable approach. Other vaccines are mRNA vaccines. They're not live virus vaccines. They apparently completed a phase two trial with 76 participants that they began in mid-June. So we're talking 2 months at most here. And they said that it produced stable immunity. Okay, so stable. Well, first of all, they didn't measure immunity. They just measured antibodies. They're assuming the antibodies are immunity, but it hasn't been.
We can't assume that.
You can't assume that, of course.
No.
And they're saying it's stable. Yeah, over how long? Over several weeks? Over maybe 6 weeks
right.
at most, I would think.
It could totally drop
based
off
upon
at
the
10 weeks.
Their own timeline. Yeah, which is what happens with a lot of other vaccines. You know, plus how did you dose it? How many dosages did you have to give? Most vaccines that are being developed have found that they need to give two doses.
Multiple.
You know, essentially a month apart. So they're at the same and actually not preliminary stage as everybody else, but actually not even quite as far along as others. They haven't even begun a phase three trial. Other vaccines are at the beginning of their phase three trial. They're planning their phase three trial, where you give it to thousands of people, tens of thousands of people, and you actually see, like, over months, are the people who got the vaccine versus who got a dummy vaccine,
that's likely,
are they more likely to not catch COVID-19? Mm-hmm. Are they less likely to catch COVID-19? That they don't have that data. They're not even releasing their data from their phase two preliminary trial. So there's no transparency. We can't look at the data. It's way too early to approve it. It's a complete propaganda stunt. It's really counterproductive, totally counterproductive.
And other countries are already saying, yeah, I'm going to buy that stuff. Like, I think Brazil said that let's make a deal, a manufacturing deal.
Oh, great.
And we'll start making that. Like, damn.
So are they going to – really? They're going to start making it based upon a phase two trial without clinical data, without efficacy data?
Yeah, that's what I read. He's
Brazil?
He was talking about
surprised.
And do you think Putin actually gave it to his daughter? I say no.
Well, he's saying that one of his daughters was one of those 76 participants, but who knows? Again,
right.
Here's the bottom line. You can't trust it, right?
Nope.
And so one of the things that we could say about it, this is why totalitarian governments can't really do science. Science requires a certain level of transparency, of freedom.
Thank you.
That just doesn't exist in these countries.
Russia's track record is not so great in this area.
And I hate to say it, but like China is the same way. China's a totalitarian government, and you can't really trust them to do transparent, honest science. And now there's these massive fraud scandals in China as well.
Yep.
It's not an isolated case, right? Yeah. I mean, I remember going back decades.
Massive,
like, it happens over and over.
Yeah. A lot of the scientists in the rest of the world, for political correctness or naivete or I don't know what, are just treating it like it's normal, like treating science coming out of these countries that we know we can't trust, but they're giving it the benefit of the doubt. But that's not, you can't do that, in my opinion, because it's just contaminating the literature with studies that cannot be trusted because they've been done in a culture that is not following the rules.
It's dangerous, especially when you're talking about applied research. Yeah. I mean, it's super dangerous with basic research too, but especially when we're talking about stuff that can affect people's lives. When you start to do science in an effort to promote a political agenda, I mean, this is a problem even in democratic societies. We have to be really careful about this. But when there's literally like a state, I don't want to call it a state religion, but a state faith, like we all saw what happened during Lysenkoism. There was a whole new idea of science that was promoted by Russia. Like, this is how science works. This is how evolution works. That was not based in fact. Mm-hmm. That's dangerous.
They still haven't really recovered, from the damage that Lysenkoism.
Oh, gosh, how far that sent them back. Oh, my gosh.
Yeah, so bad. But, I mean, the good news is, that don't you feel, Steve, like a lot of journalists are being pretty responsible in how they cover this vaccine? I've been seeing a lot of like, just because Russia said this, we've to be super critical.
Yeah, because it's so blatant.
Yeah, exactly.
There's always more, deeper layers you can go into. And I think like on science-based medicine, we've written about it. And, David Gorski wrote an article about, the need for phase three trials in developing a coronavirus vaccine. Mm. And I wrote about specifically the Russia claim today. And so we do a lot deeper, I think, than the lay media.
Oh, sure.
But the lay media is at least getting the basics right. This is preliminary. It's premature. It's propaganda. It's not appropriate.
Yeah, they're not trumpeting it as a triumph of any.
I'd be surprised if they did, Steve. Kind of. I mean, because our medical experts jumped on it immediately, and then I can't imagine a lot of major news outlets saying, "Hey, no, maybe they got something there." I mean, nobody.
No, you have to be pretty incompetent to miss it, because the scientific backlash occurred even before the mainstream media reporting. That was, see, sometimes it occurs afterwards.
Right.
Like, we learn about it from the mainstream media, and then there's a scientific backlash, and then the mainstream media has to correct itself. Yeah, they have egg all over
their face. They're too prime now.
And once again, thank goodness for Fauci, because I think he was one of the first to just come out and say, like, guys, let's not get ahead of ourselves here.
Yeah, but again, you put either religion or national pride or culture or the needs of the government, above the independence and transparency and culture of science, and it breaks. It's incompatible. Yep. You can't do it. Yeah. It just muddies the waters.
Bad results. You always get bad results.
This is gonna set back, if anything, efforts to develop a vaccine. How many are they going to divert production resources to this preliminary vaccine?
Are they going to stop doing research on other vaccines as a result of this?
Well, no. There's a lot of other countries are involved.
In Russia. In Russia, continue. Yeah.
Yeah. Terrible. I mean, it's only
minuses.
We're seeing this to a lesser degree in the U.S. when it comes to hydroxychloroquine. It was politicized. Mm-hmm. A straightforward scientific question.
And when it came to our testing kits.
Yeah. You can't politicize the science, man. We're in the middle of a pandemic. Listen to the freaking science. Listen to the experts. Don't politicize it. Don't put your nickel down on something.
Please.
Before the science is in, because you want to, whatever, be positive to the public or goose the markets or whatever, make it a point of national pride. I mean, I pointed out that, like, calling it Sputnik 5 was a little heavy-handed. Like,
that smacked me in the face. Like, are you kidding me?
That this was propaganda. This is like overkill on the pro-Russian propaganda.
I could see if they actually had something really, something legit, then that'd be a little extra smack in the head, right? But this is just like such obvious bullshit. It's so premature.
Yeah, I mean, to us, it's obvious. It's obvious to I think people who still care about facts and truth and things like that. But I do think it's so brazen is the thing. Not that, of course, politicians do this. Countries do this. Governments do this. It's just like a lot of people say, everyone lies. All politicians lie, et cetera, et cetera. But when the brazenness is increasing by orders of magnitude, I do think that's a difference. Yep. I think that there's a lot of politicians now, a lot of people, a lot of outlets think that reality is just whatever you say it is. And if you say it often enough and loud enough, that's all that matters. We can just make up our own facts and reality and just push that.
Sure. It certainly seems to be working in a lot of ways.
Well, that's the thing. There are short-term political outcomes that can come from it. I think it's a failed strategy long-term. I think there's a certain advantage to being in line with reality.
I'm biased. But, I think
with reality,
reality biased.
It's kind of like, here's an analogy that just hit me. I don't know how apt it is, but you think about like mimic butterflies, right? Mm-hmm. You could, like, the viceroy butterfly mimics the monarch butterfly. I think I got that right. Because like they're mimicking a poisonous butterfly. So birds know not to eat the poisonous butterfly. So if they look like the poisonous butterfly, they won't get eaten either. But if too many of them do that, then the birds unlearn that they're poisonous and will start to eat them again. You can get away with a little bit of it on the edge, but if it becomes the dominant mode, then the strategy fails. I don't know.
Yeah, because then it becomes Poe's law.
Yeah. Right.
No, but I like it. It's like, because at a certain point, you're like, I don't know what's even farce. Like, I'm just living in this world where nothing is trustworthy. And now all of a sudden, you're back to where you were in the beginning.
Yeah. I mean, it's not good. People don't come around to respecting facts or evidence, but it's just that, nothing is believable. So
you just get burned over and over.
Yeah. It's terrible. Yeah. All right. We're going to move on to some astronomy news. Bob, you're going to start off by telling us about CNO neutrinos. What are these things?
Okay, there's a controversy in astrophysics about the heavy elements in the sun that could change our models of the sun and, by extension, many stars in the entire universe. Pretty dramatic. To resolve this once and for all, we may be helped by a recent discovery about the ghostliest of particles, neutrinos.
The ones that are bombarding my body,
yes,
right now,
billions
penetrating
every
them?
Second. This was announced recently at this year's virtual Neutrino 2020 conference. Seems pretty appropriate for a virtual conference concerning neutrinos for some reason. So like I said, there is a controversy in astrophysics, and it all centers around our sun. Now, our sun is, of course, a star, but it's also a yardstick. Chaos is a ladder. We use that. Game of Thrones. We use that to study the universe.
Thank you.
So that yardstick is critically important for us. Now, when we look at another star or even a gas cloud to measure specific elements inside, like, you know, say nitrogen or carbon, the sun is always there as a point of reference. And it's not just because the sun is really close to us and we know more about it than any other star. It's much deeper than that. For example, if you look at the balance of elements in the stars within our galaxy, it changes whether you're by the core or by the outskirts. Our sun is halfway between those extremes. So that means that our sun actually makes a pretty decent approximation for both types of stars, or most of the stars that are in our galaxy. And then in addition, you could extend that much farther when you think that most stars are in big galaxies like the sun is as well. And that also makes the sun a good yardstick, even at the scale of the cosmos. So the sun is critically important. You might think, oh yeah, we examine these stars and we know exactly, you know, what's going on with them by looking at their light. But the fact is that we use the sun. Our sun is there helping us to interpret that data, and it's critically important. So now that changed in 2009 when astrophysicist Martin Asplund and colleagues showed with persuasive research that the sun had probably lower levels of heavy elements like carbon and oxygen. That was huge. And this research now has something like 4,000 citations, which goes to show you how impactful Asplund's data was and how freaked out astrophysicists must be.
So, Bob, is this like when the kilogram was redefined and kind of sent all other measurements like – kind of askew as a result, or everything had to change?
Kind
to
of.
That
I mean, it wouldn't be.
Measure.
I mean, if it was, you know, redefined, it was probably subtle, but this is more dramatic. You know, this impacts so many stars potentially. So, Steve, 4,000 citations for a paper, that's huge, right? I mean, that's actually. Right.
That's,
I mean, that's a way that you could evaluate.
That's a lot.
You could evaluate how historically significant some research was by how many times it's cited. And if it's not cited hardly at all, then you just don't give it much weight because it just wasn't important for any follow up. So I was saying how freaked out they must be, and they are freaked out, I think, because if he's correct, it could ripple through our understanding of stars everywhere, because that yardstick we have and will now have to be reevaluated. So how do we resolve this? Well, one way is to look at some very special neutrinos. Neutrinos, we've discussed them many times, chargeless, super light, subatomic particles that fly through a light year of lead without interacting. So these are produced in part by the fusion processes in the core of the sun. And one of those processes is called the proton-proton chain. And so this is dominant in stars of about one solar mass or lighter. So if you're looking at a star that's like our sun or lighter, it is fusing hydrogen into helium primarily using this proton-proton fusion chain. And what happens is that you've got this tremendous kinetic energy towards, you know, in the core of the star. And so much kinetic energy that the protons can overcome electrostatic repulsion and then fuse. But it's not that easy. I mean, it's a five-step process that ends with helium plus energy, part of which is neutrinos. So now 99% of the sun's energy comes from this proton chain, producing the neutrinos that we've been discovering for years now, up until very recently with this latest discovery. But have you ever asked yourself if 99% of the sun's energy comes from the proton-proton fusion chain, what about the other 1%?
Yeah, 1%. What's that all about?
Okay, so there is another fusion process in the sun, and that's called the CNO cycle, carbon-nitrogen-oxygen cycle. So stars that have more than 1.3 times the mass of the sun, they use this cycle predominantly. The sun isn't quite massive enough So it uses it only a little bit. Actually, like it's like a little bit over 1%. But if you're looking at a big star, say two solar masses, most of its energy is coming from CNO and not proton-proton. So the CNO cycle, that type of fusion uses carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen isotopes as catalysts in a six-step process to create helium. And it creates alpha particle, two positrons, as well as two electron neutrinos. These are very special neutrinos, and that's what has been detected in the Borsino particle physics experiment in Italy. And that's what it was designed to study. And the hardware and the software and the research, I mean, and everything that they've done is top notch. It was really difficult to isolate these neutrinos, and they did it. They did a great job. So the facility itself is about 18 meters tall, and it contains 280 tons of scintillating liquid. So this is a special liquid that emits a light when electrons interact with a neutrino. And it doesn't happen very often, so the more of it you have, the better. Physicist Gioacchino Ranucci from the National Institute for Nuclear Physics in Milan said, Borsino has completely unraveled the two processes powering the sun. So yeah, it really has, because this was predicted. The CNO cycle was predicted decades and decades ago, and they suspected that it produced these neutrinos, but we haven't been able to detect them until very recently. And so it is a remarkable achievement. And I was going to talk about just that achievement itself until I found out the bigger story behind it all. So here we are. So this CNO neutrino discovery is so important because these neutrinos rely on elements in the sun like carbon, nitrogen, and oxygen. So the more we know about the neutrinos, the more we know about the ratios of those elements in the sun. That, in turn, could then help us figure out which model of the sun is correct, and by implication, many, many stars in the entire universe. So, I'll be keeping an eye on this one, because if it turns out that the research from 2009 by Asplund, if that's more correct, then that ripple effect is going to travel fast, and it'll be interesting to see, you know, what we think about the universe would have to change if our models of most of the stars are going to change with it.
Yeah, it's funny. You wouldn't think. I mean, obviously, you know, unless you're very familiar with astrophysics, you know, it's hard to imagine that something that seems so esoteric as like CNO neutrinos could have such a dramatic effect on our model of how like the universe works, you know.
So 1% of the neutrinos bombarding me right now are these CNOs?
Sure. I mean, yeah, that kind of makes sense. Based on the figures that I know.
Yeah, because most of the neutrinos that are hitting the Earth are coming from our own sun,
yep.
Right?
Yep. Yeah, I mean,
Wow.
Yeah, you know, cool. You'll get hit by neutrinos from, like, supernova. Probably not too many of them reaching the Earth. Yeah, the overwhelming majority is definitely the sun.
Evan, you're going to tell us about the TESS exoplanet mission, which is just finishing, right? It's just finishing its primary mission.
Its primary mission, yep, just about done after 2 years. And this was just announced the other day, announced by NASA, that on July 4th of this year, the Transiting Exoplanet Survey Satellite, which we know as TESS, finished its primary mission. It imaged about 75% of our visible sky, and it took 2 years to do it. TESS was launched on April 18th, 2018, aboard a SpaceX Falcon 9 rocket. Cool. And TESS has been looking for exoplanets, as its name indicates. But not only just looking for the exoplanets, it does a lot more than that. First of all, for the planets that it does discover, it can look at its mass, its size, its density, the orbit. And it especially can find smaller planets, rocky planets, inside what would be the habitable zones of their host stars. And it's using the good old transit method, which we've talked about a lot on the show, monitoring stars for tiny brightness dips caused by the orbiting planets as they cross their faces, as the satellites will detect. So in two years, TESS has found 66 new exoplanets confirmed, and it has also picked up 2,100 candidates that astronomers are busily working on confirming. That's a nice chunk of data in just a little two-year period for it. And the first phase of this mission, it spent the first year of the 2 years observing 13 sectors of the southern sky, and then spent the last year imaging the northern sky. A sector is a 24 by 96 degree strip of the sky. Call them sectors, and there's good pictures online to give you an idea of what these sectors look like. But you can tell that, you know, a good chunk of the sky has been covered by TESS. So, completed the primary mission. Now it's on to the extended mission. TESS has turned around, and now it's resuming with a survey of the southern skies again. So the TESS team has introduced some improvements in the way the satellite collects and processes the data. It has four cameras on board, which capture a full image every 10 minutes, which is now three times faster than during the primary mission. This fast mode will allow the brightness of thousands of stars to be measured every 20 seconds. Thousands of stars in 20 seconds. That's so cool. And along with the previous method of collecting these observations from tens of thousands of stars every 2 minutes, which is what it was doing before. The faster measurements allows TESS to better resolve brightness changes caused by stellar oscillations to capture explosive flares from active stars in much greater detail. Very, very cool stuff. TESS has been quite a success story so far to date. Let's see among the things it has done. Not just the planetary discoveries that TESS has made, but it has observed the outburst of a comet in our solar system. It has observed in real time exploding stars, real time, you know, given the space and distance of time. But but it still is pointing, you know, in the cameras in those directions and picking them up as they occur. TESS discovered surprise eclipses in a well-known binary star system. It solved a mystery about a class of pulsating stars, and it explored a world experiencing star-modulated seasons. TESS also watched as a black hole in a distant galaxy shredded a sun-like star, of which I had to go to YouTube to sort of look at the visuals and the computer models of that occurring. So imagine this.
Cool.
Imagine this black hole, like, and this huge star around it, but it's being absolutely stripped and stretched and torn. It's just amazing cool. stuff. TESS has been great. You know, a relatively low cost investment, replacing the Kepler telescope and kind of picking up where Kepler left off. And the second phase of its mission is going to be also very cost effective, but we're just learning so much. We're really getting a good bang for our buck with TESS. And it's going to be many more years that it will be functional, operational, and be picking up tons and tons of data for us.
Again, this is one of those things like, you know, Bob, you know, you, and Evan, we heard about first in, I guess, the late 80s or the mid 80s, the idea that, oh, we're going to be able to actually see exoplanets, you know, planets around other stars. Like the idea was extraordinary. And here we are, you know, 30 years later, and we've discovered thousands of them.
An embarrassment of riches.
Yep.
Yeah. Everything they said was going to happen happened. You know, in terms of the methods used and, you know, the fact that there's just a ton of exoplanets out there. I mean, I guess we didn't really know before we found them if our solar system was typical or anomalous. But, I mean, I think everyone expected that, yeah, sure, we're going to find planets around other stars. But until you actually do, you never really know.
Right, right.
And you didn't realize there was going to be so many.
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, I guess.
Just the quantity alone, yeah. No, Kepler did a great job as well. Of picking up the data, but you know, TESS is already in a way outpacing it. So the technology just gets better and better, and that they're able to make corrections, programming changes to it's not like you can go up and fix TESS. It's at an orbit around the planet Earth. I think it goes around once every 13 days. So it's far out there around the Earth. So we're not sending any space shuttle or SpaceX or anything else up to do any repairs or changes like we used to be able to do with Hubble. This thing is out there, but we can, you know, hone in on the programming and do what the magicians over at NASA, they'll hate me for calling them that. But in any case, what they're able to do, from their station to make this even a more effective satellite and picking up that much more data is really, really a testament to their efforts.
Evan, won't that be how James Webb has to operate as well?
Yes.
It'll be just too far out for us to service it.
Too far out. We would love to get an update on James Webb telescope. So how long have we been talking about that one? I mean, that's got to be, 6 years now at least? Oh, boy.
Well, that's how long these things take.
I know, they do take a while. But in the meantime, we have TESS, so thank goodness.
Yep. All right. Bob, you're going to give us a quick update on lava tubes. I know you love the idea of building either a moon or a Mars base inside a lava tube. Tell us
more,
about the
more
update.
And more people do, Steve. Lava tubes in the news. I discussed them in podcast 643 back in November 4th, 2017. Wow. So the idea was simple. The surface of the moon is not a fun place to hang out for any length of time. Not only is there extreme temperature variation, but there's radiation, micrometeorite impacts, regolith. Don't even get me started on this moon dust. The astronauts hated it so much. It got everywhere. Super nasty stuff. And the old lava tubes from when the moon was active clearly exist in some form. And they could be very, very, very large and a much safer place for our moon people to hang their helmets. So since then, some scientists have been scienting the crap out of this idea. Were they inspired by my talk in 2017? I have no evidence. I have seen no evidence that they haven't. So, you know. So the journal Earth Science Reviews published a paper. They call lava tubes pyroducts, which is not a pyromaniac duck. It's D-U-C-T-S, pyroducts, which is exactly what lava tubes are, right? Love that. So they looked at detailed data on collapsed lava tubes on the moon and Mars, and then compared that to similar collapsed lava tubes on the Earth. And this is called, apparently, comparative planetology, which is an awesome term. Lava tubes on Earth are anywhere from 10 to 30 meters, whereas on Mars, they could be 100 times wider than that. And on the moon, 1,000 times wider than that. Truly gargantuan. I mean, you could fit a city in some of these, potentially. To counter what you might be thinking, Matteo Maseroni, who's a professor of structural and planetary geology on the Division of Geosciences of the College of Padua, said, What's most vital is that regardless of the spectacular dimension of the lunar tubes, they continue to be properly inside the roof stability threshold due to a decreased gravitational attraction. So obviously, the gravity is far, far less on the moon and even Mars. And therefore, you can have structures that just could not survive on the Earth. So even the gargantuan lava tubes that almost certainly exist on the moon are very stable because of the low gravity. And any collapsed tubes are likely, they speculate, to have been caused by meteor impacts. So don't feel that, oh, there's collapsed tubes, you know, lava tubes or pyroducts on Mars and the moon. How safe could they be? They didn't collapse. Probably most likely by their own weight. It was probably actually from meteorite impact that collapsed them. So there could be there could just be so many of these huge tubes on both planets, and especially the moon. They could be gargantuan. So it just seems like a no-brainer, you know, because if we go there and build structures, it's going to take time. We'll have to use what's available there, and you can create some sort of mooncrete. Right, you can build these structures that are made out of the regolith. But man, we've got these lava tubes. Yeah, we've got these lava tubes right there that will protect you from all the hazards of living on the surface. So yeah, to me, it just seems like
meteorites.
You know, you could put entire cities inside of these gargantuan structures. So
yeah,
wait. So you say wide? That's like the tunnel size, like from not the length, but it's physically the size that you'd be standing in the tunnel.
Right. So the tunnel on the moon, a lava tunnel on the moon, they're saying by their calculations could be 10 to 30 kilometers wide and 40 kilometers long.
Right.
So that's huge.
Oh, that's enormous.
Gosh. Yeah.
And the moon, you know, how much smaller is the moon than the Earth? So it just the ratio is like out of whack.
Yeah, I definitely think there will be a future in which there will be a moon base inside a lava tube. I think that's probably going to happen.
Hell yeah.
Yep, and they'll find a monolith. Oh, wait, no. That's read that in a book once.
All right, we're going to do one email. This one comes from Pepe Smith, who gives his location as Raleigh, North Carolina / Hong Kong. Because he goes back and forth. And he writes, Steve, pretty pleased with Cheese and Jay's farts. Whoa. Talk about Benford's Law.
Wow. that doesn't win you points. Parts. Come on.
Not my attention, that's for sure. Okay.
Benford's Law.
Have any of you guys heard of Benford's Law?
Is that a mathy thing?
It's a mathy thing. It's a totally mathy thing.
Okay.
All right. So I've heard about it before, and I kind of had like a vague intuition about what the cause of it is, but apparently nobody really knows exactly what's causing it. Here it is. It's an observation that holds true remarkably well. The idea is if you look at any large data set of numbers, right, a large data set of numbers, especially if the numbers span more than one order of magnitude, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
If you count up the you know, how many numbers have a leading digit 1, how many have a leading digit 2, et cetera, that there is a logarithmic relationship where the higher the number, the lower the incidence as the leading digit. So one is about 30, about a third, about 31, 32%. 2 is 17%. You know, then it goes down from there. Down and 8 and 9 is getting down to around 4.7 to 5%, you know. And so there's a pretty consistent decrease as you go from 1 to 9, the digits 1 to 9. So not a non-zero leading digit. That observation was actually made by two people independently. Benford was the second person to make the observation. So Newcomb was the first one. Sometimes they call it the Newcomb-Benford law, but, you know, most people just call it the Benford-Benford or Benford's law. So in any case, they both observed that in tables, logarithmic tables, where you know, statisticians, mathematicians would look up, you know, logarithmic numbers, that the pages that were of the lower numbers were much dirtier and more manhandled, you know, than or person handled than the higher numbers, right? So the pages like 1 and 2 were all frequently used, and 8 and 9 were very little. So then he decided to just mathematically explore that, and he found that, yeah, pretty much any large data set you look at has this pattern. And it could be anything. Like, there's no physical relationship. It could be house numbers. It could be social security numbers. It could be the weight of something, or it could be tax returns, or anything, any large data set of numbers. There just has to be, yeah, population numbers. There has to be a couple of rules, though. So it can't be a set of numbers that's constrained in some way. For example, like if you did height in feet, obviously that's constrained. It's going to be between 4 and 6, you know, whatever, as the leading number.
Yeah,
so it doesn't really work for that. And it has to be a large enough set of numbers as well. And the range can't be narrow. And it has to be organic, like just randomly occurring in some way. There can't be some factor that is determining the numbers. Like if you can't do, like if you're looking at something where a person is consciously creating those numbers, it won't show this pattern. But if it's, you know, so the numbers are emerging randomly or organically, it does show the pattern.
So can you just explain one more time what the pattern you're saying? Because to me, maybe I'm just missing something. It sounds like obviously anytime there's just a huge data set of numbers, it's going to have more numbers that start with lower digits because you start at the bottom and you work your way up and eventually it stops somewhere.
Yeah. Well, that's the question. Is that the reason? Is that all we're seeing? But it even occurs, it even occurs in data sets that are not counting, that are just random. That are completely...
Oh, okay. So it's not like all the house numbers or all the zip codes. Well, of course, they're all going to be front-loaded because eventually you just have to stop making zip codes or house numbers. But random collection, even generated by a random number generator?
So, no, but it has to be... No, it has to be like describing something in reality.
Okay,
so,
gotcha.
Counting quantities of something.
Exactly. Some kind of numbering system. So, but you're right. That was sort of my intuition, Kara, too. That's exactly, I still think that may be playing a role in here. Cause like, it's not just that you're counting and you're stopping at some point. Cause the data set has to be large. So there's, let's say, multiple instances of counting. But isn't it more likely that any sequence of numbers that is essentially counting will include 10 before 50 or 100 before 500, for example? That the higher you go, but mathematicians think that's too simple an explanation.
Huh.
And when you try to test it, it doesn't really explain it. And so there's other propositions, like other mathematicians have proposed that it's more has to do with, like, if you increase 100 by 100, you actually double it. But if you increase 800 by 100, you only go up, you know, by
12%.
By 12%, 800 to 900. So it takes a lot more effort, and so systems tend to spend more of their time at the lower end of that sequence.
Huh.
It's, I don't know. I think the couple things about this. One is the fact that it defies any intuitive explanation. I think, tells us how non-intuitive math is in a lot of ways. Statistics, right. Especially statistics. Yeah, our brains don't grok, you know, statistics intuitively. And Benchford's law, observationally, it is rock solid. You know, it's a very well-established pattern, but we don't really fully understand it, even mathematicians. Again, there are theories, but nothing that really... there's no consensus around, yes, definitely this is the one answer, or this is the reason for this. There's just something about the way numbers work that we just have a hard time understanding. But again, I think these things that we're talking about probably are playing a role in there somewhere, but it might be it's just more of a downstream effect, not the core phenomenon, you know. The other thing is that, if someone is making up numbers out of whole cloth, then Benford's law doesn't apply, because now you're just looking at psychology, like our inability to actually generate realistic sequences of numbers. And so where does that lead to, Kara? What do you think about that? That is becomes a method for detecting fraud. Absolutely.
Right. Yeah. That's true.
You could look at a large set of numbers and tell if there's any monkey business going around, because if it does not follow a Benford's law logarithmic distribution,
you have to question it.
There's been some hanky-panky. And so this has actually been used to detect fraud.
Oh, cool.
There's some famous movie examples of when people have done it. But in real life, yeah, it's been used to detect, like, tax fraud, for example. Like, if you're cooking the books, the books should follow Benford's law, but not if you're making up the numbers, because then there's going to be cognitive biases are going to be in there, and then the distribution is going to be not truly organic or random, right? So... Mm-hmm. Yeah, so it works well enough that we could use it for fraud detection, even without really fully understanding it, which is really interesting.
I wonder if AI will be able to untangle that for us and give us an answer.
Maybe. So, but here's the thing. So I spent, you know, hours investigating this.
Oh, gosh.
Because it's interesting. And it's like, oh, I wanted to find out, is there an answer? What is the cause of Benford's law? And most references only describe it without really getting into the cause. And those that got into, like, speculating about the cause were very unsatisfactory. It didn't really get anything that I thought was like the answer. But of course, I'm not a statistician. I'm not a mathematician or an expert in this. So if there's anybody listening out there who thinks that they know the answer, or who has some insight that I didn't come across in my research, let us know, because it is interesting, you know. And I do want to know, you know, beyond what I've read, you know, what do experts out there think about it? You know, is it the kind of thing where every statistician has their pet theory about it? You know, anyway, let us know. We often get contacted by people who have expertise, you know, in the things that we talk about, and it's always fascinating. But you know, Pepe, I'm sorry, I don't have the answer. You know, I don't have any massive insight into this. You know, it's interesting, it's real, clearly, but yeah, it defies easy explanation.
We did talk about it.
Yeah, we did talk about it.
So you got your wish.
All right, guys, let's go on with science or fiction.
It's time for science or fiction.
Each week, I come up with 3 science news items for facts, 2 real and 1 fake. And I challenge my panel of skeptics to tell me which one is the fake. All right, no theme this week, just 3 news items. Are you guys all ready?
Ready.
Ready.
All right, here we go. Item number 1, a new review of dinosaurs closely related to birds finds that powered flight evolved independently at least 3 times in this group. Item number 2, an analysis finds that TSA likely missed 4,600 firearms in carry-on luggage for air travel between 2014 and 2019. And item number 3, a comparison of wheat varieties from 1891 to 2010 finds that modern wheat has as much as 50% more gluten than the older cultivars. All right, Evan, since you were the quiz master last week, why don't you go first this week?
You're saying it's revenge time.
No, you know, I just got to pick somebody some mind.
And I haven't been first in a while, so... Glad to be first. The first one has a new review of dinosaurs closely related to birds, finds that powered flight evolved independently at least 3 times in this group. Okay, that's interesting. So if I were to visualize this as like a two-dimensional kind of bush in three different directions, the bush grew and three times independently flight was achieved among those groups. Is that sort of a rough way of looking at it?
At least three different branches independently evolved powered flight.
Wow.
You know, only one of them went on to be what, you know, modern birds.
Oh boy. That's nothing I've heard of before. That's fascinating. I wouldn't be surprised if this one turns out to be science, because that's wonderful in a way. Gee, I don't know. Maybe I'll have to look at the other two a little more closely to figure out this first one by process of elimination. Meaning that the second one about TSA, the Transportation Safety Authority, likely missed 4,600 firearms in carry-on luggage in between 2014-2019. That's a big number. But is it a big enough number in comparison to the number of flyers in the United States TSA flight system? And that's probably, when you look at it in that comparison, it's probably a teeny tiny, teensy weensy percent, fraction of a percent of a percent. So I have a feeling that although it's alarming that that happened, I think it's going to turn out to be true. The last one, with the wheat varieties, 1891 to 2010, 50% more gluten than the older cultivars. Well, why would that be the case? It must be some sort of crossbreeding or contamination or something along those lines over the course of that time, in which the gluten content went along for the DNA ride with that one. That strikes me as correct as well. So all three are correct and none are science. I have sniffed out this week's trick, science or fiction. All right. Well, I guess because I'm the least confident maybe in that first one about the dinosaurs for no other reason, I guess I'll have to choose that one as the fiction. But I would not be surprised if I'm wrong about that.
All right, Bob.
Yeah, I could see any of these being science or fiction. So it was a good job this week. Let's see, the firearms. I mean, who would bring a gun, a real gun, not a fake gun for a costume like I did a few years ago? But a real gun, and put it in a suitcase. Like, what? All right.
Carry on luggage. Yeah.
I mean, yeah. So yeah. And like Evan said, it's probably tiny, and they just probably did a little study, and they extrapolate. Oh boy, we probably missed 4,600 of them. So yeah, it seems reasonable. And then the gluten one, sure, why not? Jesus, who knows? You know, sure. I mean, I don't see anything that's like, no, this is totally ridiculous. So I'm going to go with Evan, or I will agree with Evan, that the powered flight developing independently three times. Yeah, I would have thought we would have heard about it when they found the second one. And now all of a sudden they got three. So yeah, I'll say that one's hopefully fiction. But it'd be cool if it was science.
Mm. Okay. And Kara.
I don't know. It sounds really hard. It's not that it doesn't feel like any of them could be fiction. It's one of those few times where it feels like they're all science.
That's what I felt too.
Yeah. I mean, especially because once you clarified, Steve, that the dinosaurs evolved independently three times, pre-bird dinosaurs evolved powered flight independently three times, but only the one line made it to be. So it's not like there are three modern examples of evolved flight. It's one of them persisted, the other ones died out. That makes that one more believable to me. And then likely missed 4,600. Okay, likely. So that sounds like it's an estimate. So, okay. Air travel between 2014 and 2019. It's 5 years. Yeah. And Bob, I mean, a lot of people bring guns when they travel because they go on hunting trips and things like that. And some people are paranoid and they travel with weapons. It's weird, but
yeah, but I think if you're a hunter, you would declare it.
Yeah, exactly. Right? Like, that's the thing. It should be a legal gun that you have declared. And I think then it has to be checked. So you're right, if it's in your carry-on. I once accidentally almost boarded a plane with pepper spray. They had no idea. I went through multiple checkpoints and they had no idea. Whoa. And it was on my keychain. And then as I was about to board the plane, I was like, oh, am I allowed to have this? And they were like, how the hell did that make it through so many checkpoints?
Oh my gosh.
So that one seems like it could be science.
So you
maybe
pepper sprayed yourself as punishment?
Right, yeah. Like, I'm very sorry. No, and then, I don't know, I think it's the wheat one that sticks out to me as a fiction. I feel like this one could explain more celiac, but 50% more gluten seems really high. And maybe there is no more celiac. I think it's one of those things where, like, it's like autism. Like, we want to say that there's just way more examples of it because something has changed in the environment, but it could just be that we know how to
measure it, identify
prescribe.
It.
Yeah. Identify. Diagnose. Thank you. Diagnose. Thank you. you don't prescribe a diagnosis. That we just know how to diagnose it more. So I'm gonna part with the guys, even though that would be my second choice would be the dinosaurs. But I'm gonna say it's the wheat. That's the fiction.
Okay, so you guys are all pretty confident on that second one, so why don't we start there?
Oh, crap.
An analysis finds that TSA missed 4,600 firearms and carry-on luggage for air travel between 2014 and 2019. You all think this one is science, and this one is science.
Okay.
Yeah,
that's
yay.
Pretty scary. that means, that's a lot of flights where people had guns on board in the cabin in their carry-on luggage that was not declared and not known. So there's an interesting study. The point of the study actually was looking at the effect of pre-check on this factor. What do you think? Is pre-check a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah. I would think maybe good because, well, I don't know. Everything still goes through the metal detector.
So they're saying that pre-check is a very good thing because by pre-screening low-risk people, it allows TSA agents to focus more time and attention on the not-so-low-risk passengers. And so if you maximize the number of pre-checks that you could get, then they should be able to find more contraband, weapons, et cetera.
Yeah,
But then if they do that, then there'll be so many people in pre-check that they get pissed off because, like, oh, this line's just as long as the regular line.
Well, I know they may need to make more than one pre-check line. They have to balance that. No, I agree. The more people sign up for the pre-check, the less of an advantage it is. Mm-hmm. But it's actually TSA's interest, not just the passenger's interest. It's still faster.
It's also,
you don't have to take
your shoes.
Yeah, it's
way faster. You don't have to take off your shoes. Don't have to take out your laptop. You just go.
Yeah, yeah. The idea is that they're saying, you want to focus on high-risk people, not high-risk objects. So they're saying, there were no events related to these 4,600 firearms on planes, so if they had not missed them, it wouldn't have changed anything. But by focusing on higher risk people, sorting out people into low and high risk, that's a better way to approach it. I think most people are not like looking to hijack planes. They just are, maybe they forgot it was in there or they like to travel with a weapon or whatever. They have some reason why they need to get from point A to point B with a weapon. But I would be, can you imagine going through security with knowing that you have a illegal firearm in your carry-on? Wouldn't you be a nervous wreck?
Hell yeah, you would.
Yeah. Can you screen for nervous wrecks in airports? Are we up to that level of sophistication?
Well, do they profile really people? Yeah, who look nervous as hell. They should.
I think so. In some airports, I'm sure that.
Well, and I think with like the increases or I guess the advancements in AI guided computer vision, I think you're going to be able to start seeing the facial recognition of emotional states.
Yeah.
Like that guy looks shady AF. Mm-hmm. Like we need to talk to him.
Yeah, a little bit. He looks like he's hiding something. Using AI to detect behavior and facial expressions and movements and whatever.
Yeah.
And just for our non-American listeners, TSA is the Transportation Security Administration. They're the ones who handle security at airports in the U.S. So these numbers were purely for the U.S. All right, let's go back to number one. A new review of dinosaurs closely related to birds finds that powered flight evolved independently at least three times in this group. Bob and Evan think this one is the fiction. Kara, you think this one is science. And this one is...
Say it.
Science.
Oh, yes.
Good job, Kara.
Yes.
At least three
cool.
times.
Cool. Thanks for the clarification, too. That really helps,
three times.
Steve.
It probably could be more. Yeah, it wasn't within birds. It was this group, the theropod dinosaurs closely related to birds, are called the Pairavens. They also have a name for dinosaurs that have feathers. Just like, it's not a cladistic group, but it is, you know, they just basically, you know, it's a non-cladistic group, right? So, because feathers evolved multiple times. So essentially you had this group of theropod dinosaurs that were small, had like all of the features that were make it likely favorable to evolve in this direction. They already have lots of, you know, the potential to evolve feathers. They have downy stuff. And, they were experimenting with all kinds of, you know, just evolutionarily experimenting with all kinds of different wing structures and feather structures. And there were a lot of gliders. And at least three times, completely independently, you know, once you have a group of feathered dinosaurs within that group, you know, three of them, many of them went to gliding flight, and three of them at least went to powered flight. They suspect that more will, you know, when we find more evidence, the number will even be higher. So it was just ripe for that to happen, you know, evolutionarily speaking. You have a diverse group of small feathered dinosaurs, you know, that the flight was right there. You know, they just had at least three times, different species stepped over that threshold. So very interesting.
So what were the differences, though, between these three different methods, three different little branches, right? Well, bone structure or something?
Yeah, well, remember, like, the biggest difference, and I think this counts as one of them, so Microraptor had four wings.
We talked about that.
Avatar.
Cool. They had feathers on the hind legs as well as the forelimbs.
I'm pissed that didn't dominate. What the hell? Come on, evolution.
Or imagine if we had multiple, you know, flying dinosaur species alive that survived to the modern times.
Well, then we probably would have all guessed that that was science.
Yeah, it would have totally changed my guess.
Probably. All right, so all this means that a comparison of wheat varieties from 1891 to 2010 finds that modern wheat has as much as 50% more gluten than the older cultivars. This one is the fiction.
Boring.
Kara totally nailed this. I mean, she figured out why this was wrong. So the reason they were even looking at this was to see if changes in the cultivars of wheat over the last 100 years or so could be an explanation for why we're diagnosing more celiac disease, more non-celiac gluten hypersensitivity, which, you know, is still a controversial diagnosis. And what they found was, the amount, the overall amount of gluten is basically unchanged. That there's slight differences in the different subtypes, you know, of protein, like the gliadin versus the glutenin, but nothing that would explain any resistance. In fact, the kind of gluten that is most linked to gluten sensitivity was a little decreased, if anything, in the modern
world.
Over the
historical.
So it basically has nothing to do with the cultivars, the genetics of the wheat. And what they did find, actually, that the environmental factors, like how rainy was it that year, had more of an effect on the wheat proteins than the cultivar. So it's just not a matter of the different cultivars of wheat. And there's no pattern.
So do they think it's just we're more aware or we're looking for it more now?
I mean, that wasn't the point of the study, but that, that would certainly be, it would support that interpretation, or at least this fails to provide support for the notion that there's actually more wheat sensitivity because there's something different about the wheat. You know, they're finding that there basically isn't. And the little change that they defined are actually moving in the wrong direction, if anything. Interesting.
Well, I don't have a celiac, but gluten hurt me on this one, that's for sure.
They're a little sensitive to gluten now.
I'm a little more sensitive than I was before.
Yeah, so I'm fascinated with that whole concept. You know, and again, I'm not convinced that non-celiac gluten sensitivity even is a real thing. Again, I do think it's a matter of we're looking for it more. It's the availability
like
heuristic.
Autism?
You guys know the availability heuristic is that we search for answers that are at our fingertips, right? That are available to us.
Sure.
And so everyone who comes in with, you know, a rash thinks they have Lyme disease. You know, why? Because they know about it. That's a word that they know, you know. It's something that they read about. It's an available diagnosis to them. So
like
if
looking
everyone
under
has,
the lamplight, where the lamplight is.
Yeah, so you're looking, yeah, you're looking where the light is good, not where, you know, the actual evidence is to be found. Or, you know, if you have abdominal symptoms, bloating, whatever, and other symptoms, fatigue, etc., you're not going to think that you have something you've never heard of, right? You're going to think you have the thing that's in the news and that people are talking about, but it doesn't make it real.
Yeah, 5G caused me all kinds of problems. That must be what's illing me these days, because I read about 5G. Right.
Yeah, the other thing that happens a lot is then people will cut out a lot of things from their diet. They'll cut out, you know, gluten, but in the process they cut out a lot of things that go along with that. But they also decrease their caloric intake, they lose weight, et cetera, and then they feel better, and they think it's the gluten, but they didn't really control for that variable. You know, they mixed in a lot of other variables there. Plus, there's also the effect that we see very commonly in medicine is that you have, you know, a chronic symptoms, right? That doesn't mean you're going to have them forever. You know, some people have things that last a year or two, or, you know, it's going to run its course. And then they try multiple different things. They just keep trying new treatments, new ideas. And whatever they happen to be doing when their symptoms improved anyway, naturally,
yeah,
that's what gets the credit, you know?
Sure.
Right. Yeah.
And the more unusual it was, the more likely they are to shout it from the rooftops, you know, because it justifies their decision to go out on a limb and try something weird or something that maybe even the people around them were saying, that's crazy, that's not it.
So the psychology involved is very strong here.
Yeah, there's
It is, because it relates to, oh gosh, what do they call that, Steve? The food thing, where if you eat something and then you get really ill, there's such a strong emotional reaction.
Yeah.
It'll keep you from eating it again. You see it in mammals a lot, like rats, because they don't have a gag reflex, so they can't throw things up. So they'll watch another rat eat something. Oh, food aversion. It's such like a deep psychological kind of reaction. And of course, I can see how it translates to all these other areas.
Well, yeah, disgust is a fundamental emotion, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's there just to make that association between consuming something and not feeling well and just erring on the side of, okay, that I was sick when I ate that, so I'm going to assume it was that, and now I'm disgusted with it. I don't want to
even look at it. It would help if we were all like foragers still, but unfortunately, I feel like almost everybody has an example of like, oh, I can't eat the red jelly beans anymore because that time I puked them all up.
Yeah.
Even though it's like, that is not what made you sick. You just can't do it. You can't go near it.
Yeah. Yeah. I know a lot of people have had that experience.
Yeah.
All right. Good job, Kara.
Yeah.
Thanks.
Well done.
Yeah. Yeah.
Kevin, give us a quote.
All right. This week's quote was suggested by a listener, Bruce from California. Last initial P. Bruce P. from California. Thank you, Bruce. I like this one. To treat your facts with imagination is one thing, but to imagine your facts is another. And that was written by John Burroughs, American naturalist, nature essayist, one of the most popular ones of his time, in the late 1800s and early 1900s, and was very much part of the burgeoning U.S. conservation movement that was taking place in America and other places at that time, you know, Teddy Roosevelt, among other famous conservationists, and he was among them. So, and he's written a lot of great stuff. So, John Burroughs.
Yeah, I like that quote. So, guys, before we close out, I want to let everybody know, you know, we had our Nexus 2 weeks ago. That was the episode that we aired last week.
Mm-hmm.
And it went really well. Everyone, a lot of positive feedback. People seemed to really enjoy that, you know, digital conference.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of other people are doing that as well. So on this Sunday after this comes out, this will be Sunday, August 16th from 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. That is Australian Eastern Time. This is the Canberra Skeptics are going to have a digital conference. So if you want to register for that, I know about this because I'm going to be on one of the panels.
Uh-huh.
Oh, cool.
So I will be there. So the successes and failures of science, skepticism, and critical thinking should be interesting.
Oh, boy.
Our friend Richard Saunders is moderating that panel. Susan Gerbic will be there. I'll be there and a bunch of other skeptics. So if you want to go to that, you could register via Zoom. Go to canberraskeptics.org and check it out. And Hopefully we'll see some of you there on Sunday, August 16th. All right. Well, thank you guys for joining me this week.
Sure, man.
Thank you, Steve.
Thanks, Steve.
And until next week, this is your Skeptic's Guide to the Universe. Skeptic's Guide to the Universe is produced by SGU Productions, dedicated to promoting science and critical thinking. For more information, visit us at theskepticsguide.org. Send your questions to info@theskepticsguide.org. And if you would like to support the show and all the work that we do, go to patreon.com/skepticsguide and consider becoming a patron and becoming part of the SGU community. Our listeners and supporters are what make SGU possible.